From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A call for an independent inquiry into Persian Gulf war sickness and depleted uranium. We look at the Medal of Dishonor, how the Pentagon radiates soldiers and civilians with depleted uranium weapons.
Well, in the past, nuclear war was when you blew up bombs with fission, and you had the most incredibly massive blast effects and radiation effects. Now, this nuclear war is different. The Gulf War was, in truth, a nuclear war. Almost 1 million depleted uranium shells were used.
Also, leasing the ivory tower, the corporate takeover of academia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton opened his first trip to Latin America by trying to soften tensions with Mexico over immigration restrictions and illegal drugs, declaring himself a good friend to the people of Mexico. In a modest symbol of the administration's support, the State Department announced it would give Mexico $6 million to help fight drug trafficking. Clinton arrived last night after a four-hour flight from Washington and toured the National Museum of Anthropology with Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo. Their work begins today with private talks and a news conference at the museum. The two presidents posed for pictures before an Aztec calendar dating back somewhere between the 10th and 15th centuries. Meanwhile, as President Clinton arrived in Mexico City, there were a number of protests with more than a dozen people arrested. While AIDS deaths are increasing for women as they fall for men, women's infections are often missed as the disease follows a different course. This, according to new research presented yesterday. Women's HIV often is missed because doctors aren't recognizing that vaginal infections, yeast infections of the mouth and throat, and cervical cancer are part of the disease. President Clinton's second-term roster could be rounded out this week. The Senate Intelligence Committee opens hearings today for George Tenet, the man nominated to head the CIA. Tenet faces a warmer climate than the one that greeted Anthony Lake, President Clinton's first choice for the job. Lake withdrew from consideration after facing stiff opposition from committee chair Richard Shelby. Although Shelby says he expects Tenet to be confirmed, Tenet faces tough questioning on several issues. They include why the CIA did a poor job of keeping the military informed about the threat of chemical weapons during the Persian Gulf War. Tenet is currently the agency's acting director. After nearly 3 years, a strike and presidential intervention, American Airlines and its pilots finally have a contract. A five-year contract was approved by 69% of the Allied Pilots Association's members yesterday. Despite the overwhelming majority, the union's still wary about losing the right to fly regional jets. This news from Botswana. U.S. Envoy Bill Richardson ended talks with the leaders of Uganda, Zimbabwe, and Tanzania in Botswana today. And he said he had received helpful advice on a peaceful transition of power in Zaire. Richardson met Ugandan leader Yoweri Museveni, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, and Tanzania's Benjamin Mkapa for more than an hour at a lodge in the Botswana border town of Kasane, where they're attending a business conference. President Jacques Chirac of France was poised today to try to kickstart his center-right government's lackluster election campaign, with opinion polls showing the leftist opposition within striking distance of an upset win. Chirac was expected to publish an article in 12 regional dailies tomorrow in a risky effort to nudge bored voters into backing Prime Minister Alain Juppé's coalition for the May 25th, June 1st National Assembly poll. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Before we move on with the first segment of the show, we thought it would be interesting to follow up on a story that we have been bringing you on Democracy Now!, and that is the story of Anthony Baez, the young South Bronx man who was killed by a police officer when the football he was playing with his brothers hit a police officer's car on the edge of their property. The police officer, Francis Lavoti, got out, put Anthony Baez in a chokehold, and he died. Well, his mother and father have been outspoken since his death in December of 1994, calling for justice. And today, Iris Baez, his mother, announced that she would be running for Bronx Borough President. I got a chance to talk to her about it.
I'm getting ready to set off a campaign and to run for Bronx Borough President.
Why are you running?
Well, because I've noticed in a couple of years that we don't have no justice. In the past 2 years, we haven't had any justice. And as I keep on going and meeting more people, I met that everybody is confused about this government, that everybody don't get answers. We go to the courthouse, we don't get answers. We go to our legislators, we don't get answers. And they tell us, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And we keep on sitting down and with no answers and just cry. And that has to stop. That's why I'm running for borough president and to make a change for the community. I went into City Hall and I read a statement on the wall that says the government of the people for the people. And that's, you know, nobody's for nobody. From what I'm seeing, you know, we have to stand up and demand our rights. We have to stand up and say, this is mine. I want this because it's my right. You understand? And now we don't have that. Other people think that they're powerless, but they're not. I discovered that we are not powerless, that we can make a change.
In addition to a big button of your son that you're wearing, a photograph of your son, you're wearing a Green Party campaign button,
yes,
which is a sunflower.
Yes, that's the party that I'm running for, because it stands for, you know, clean air. It stands for the environment. It stands for we have to stop this corporation coming in and putting incinerators in our backyard. You know, we have to stop a lot of things that are coming into the city that we have to stop, because it's not only endangering our lives, it endangering our children and our elderly.
In fact, Anthony had asthma, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, Anthony had asthma. Well, I used to live in the South Bronx. Now I moved up a little bit. But even back then, it was bad, you know, like to breathe. We had a place around where I used to live that they used to burn garbage. And that in itself, it's an endanger.
Did you ever think that you would see yourself running for political office three years ago?
Never. I never even dreamed of it.
What changed for you?
Well, I've seen the Republican and the Democrat, when they're in power, I've seen that how they just get the power, but don't go out to the community. Don't see what their needs are. And this is where we're going to make a change.
Iris Baez, Democracy Now! Is a national show. You're running for a local office in New York City,
yes,
in a part of New York City, the borough of the Bronx. You're
yes,
running for Bronx Borough President. What message do you have for people around the country? Why do you think your
wake up, and when they start sending messages, the government sent messages ahead. This is what I learned in these two. The government sent a message out. And when they say that we're going to build more jails, the people say, oh, yeah, the criminals got to get off the street. But what criminals? You understand? They're only putting our youth in jail. They're not going up to those criminals in a white shirt, blue tie. They're not going after them. They're not going after the drugs that is coming into our city. If we're going to make a difference, it's all of us together. It's a whole community.
Iris Baez, the mother of Anthony Baez, killed in December of 1994 by a New York City police officer, announcing her candidacy for the presidency of the borough of the Bronx. Well, Juan Gonzalez joins us today, my co-host and columnist with the New York Daily News. Interesting news, isn't it, Juan?
Yeah, I think that Iris Byers will definitely inject a lot more substance into the some of the political campaigning in New York, certainly raise the continuing issue of police brutality, the epidemic of police brutality that's existed. In that sense, her candidacy will force anyone else in the race, and it's not quite clear all of the candidates who will be running for borough president in the Bronx. Jose Rivera, the councilman, is probably going to be one of them, and Shirley Reminiske, an old-time political Democratic Party operative. So we'll see what happens, but she will definitely force everyone to address the issues more.
No question about that. She is running for the seat that is now occupied by Fernando Ferrer, who is a longtime politician who will be running for mayor of the city of New York. Well, on another issue, dealing with another topic, May is graduation month, and throughout the country, students are dusting off their shoes and putting on a cap and gown. But behind the graduation celebrations, American universities have been undergoing a dramatic change in recent years. Large corporations, conservative foundations, and well-heeled executives have been busy buying the ivory tower and transforming it into an annex for industry. Joining us to talk about this is Lawrence Soley, a professor of communications at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And he's author of a book called Leasing the Ivory Tower, as well as an article in the latest issue of Covert Action magazine, Covert Action Quarterly. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Oh, thank you.
Well, tell us about your research into the takeover, the corporate takeover of academia.
Well, it's been slow, and it's been invisible, and it hasn't been talked about. Instead, for the first few years of the 1990s, there was a lot of talk about political correctness, how African-American nationalists, Marxists, and feminist activists have taken over the ivory tower, when in fact, control of the ivory tower has been in the hands of CEOs. They have dominated the board of trustees and the board of regents at universities across the country, and they select presidents and other executives that mirror their worldview, that see the world from the perspective of CEOs. And in fact, as most people in New York know, the executives of universities in the New York City area see themselves as CEOs and oftentimes lavish themselves with huge salaries, or like Ann Reynolds at the City University of New York, also sits on the boards of directors of large corporations that in turn oftentimes oversee the direction of universities. And there has been an increasingly symbiotic relationship between the two, and in fact a study on university-corporate relationships reported that there has been a virtual explosion over the past several years in the number and variety of university-industry alliances.
Well, Lawrence Soley, I guess many Americans are familiar with the university's increasing tendency to want to have contracts in there for their sports teams with various corporations. But you go much more into detail in some of the other manifestations. I was particularly fascinated by the point system that you described at MIT in terms of how faculty can gain points for all kinds of freebies for providing services to corporations. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, at Massachusetts Institute of Technology at MIT, there's a program that's called the Industrial Liaison Program, and it's specifically designed to solicit memberships from corporations. And there are about 300 different corporations that belong to this program, each of which throws in between $10,000 and $50,000 a year to belong. And professors at the university get points for making contact with these corporations. And they get different types of points depending upon the level of the relationship. So if they actually visit a corporate executive suite, they get more points than if they merely send a research report to an executive. The point is that most of the research being done at MIT, along with most of the research being done at universities across the country, is funded by federal tax dollars. It's federally funded, and it's supported by us taxpayers, and yet the primary beneficiaries of it, the ones who see the results of it, oftentimes before anyone else is allowed to see the results, are CEOs or researchers for corporations that didn't fund the research. One thing that took place in 1980 that really went unnoticed was the passage of an act commonly known as the Dole-Buy Act or the University Small Business Patents Procedure Act that allowed universities for the first time to sell or license directly to corporations the rights to federally funded research. And they're allowed to sell those rights, of course, for far less than the cost of the research because the university isn't funding the research anyway. So the taxpayers come in, they may spend multi-millions of dollars for the research, and then corporations come in and for a fraction of that buy the results of the research. And so that was a change in 1980 that really stimulated the increase in contacts between universities and corporations. Corporations now see a direct benefit by coming in and signing research contracts or grants or setting up endowed chairs or funding programs of study or research centers and that type of thing. Whereas in the past, prior to 1980, they didn't see the direct benefits. And as a consequence, prior to 1980, there were far fewer but still contacts between corporations and universities.
One of the greatest threats, it seems, of corporate takeover or corporate involvement with universities is the secrecy involved. We know it from Pentagon research at universities, where professors and even students are sworn to secrecy, which is sort of defies the whole idea of open inquiry. You give the example of a British pharmaceutical corporation, the Boots Company, giving $250,000 to the University of California, San Francisco for research looking at its drug Synthroid. This is something that came out a little bit in the news after your report came out, but tell us about it.
Well, that's a fairly typical example of what happens when universities and corporations sign direct contracts for research. What happened was that Boots Pharmaceutical is a manufacturer of a drug called Synthroid that actually has a number of generic substitutes out there, or at least drugs that claim to be generic substitutes. And the research called for University of San Francisco researcher Betty Ding to actually investigate whether or not the generics were direct substitutes for Synthroid. Well, what her results showed was that they were, and that Boots Pharmaceutical should not be claiming that there were no substitutes. Of course, if there are substitutes, the price of their drug would drop. People could turn to the substitutes. And what happened after the research was done is they tried to block the publication of research, and they actually succeeded for quite a number of years. And what they claimed was that the research that they had funded and the research techniques that were utilized that they had approved previously were now somehow flawed. And that was the rationale that they used for prohibiting the university from publishing it, or I should say the researcher from funding it. But that type of contract exists in a lot of research contracts that exist between corporations and universities. As I point out in Covert Action Quarterly, there is a similar type of contract that existed between the geology department at the University of Texas and Freeport-McMoRan that was contracting with university researchers to do research for them in Indonesia. And Juan mentioned a little while ago the types of relationships between sports teams at universities and clothing manufacturers and shoe manufacturers. And a good example of that type of contract existed at the University of Wisconsin, where they signed a contract with Reebok. And in that contract was a paragraph requiring the university to take action to remedy any statements made by their employees that put Reebok in a bad light. Now, there are a tremendous number of protests that arose from that because that contract was very public. It was very visible. And as a result of that public relations disaster, of course, the university asked Reebok to remove that portion of that phrase from the contract, which Reebok, of course, facing a public relations disaster, agreed to do. But nevertheless, those types of provisions exist in a lot of contracts signed between universities and corporations.
We're talking to Professor Lawrence Soley, professor of communications at Marquette University in Milwaukee. He's author of the book Leasing the Ivory Tower, also a piece by the same title in the latest issue of Covert Action Quarterly. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and when we come back, we're going to continue with this discussion. Think about these, as Lawrence Soley puts it, corporate easy chairs, the Ronald Reagan Chair of Broadcasting in Alabama, the Lego Professor of Learning Research at MIT, Dow Chemical Company Research Professor of Chemistry at Northwestern, Sears Roebuck Professor of Economics at Chicago, Federal Express Chair of Excellence in Information Technology in Memphis, Bell South Professor of Education through Telecommunication, South Carolina, Coca-Cola Professor of Marketing in Georgia. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, and Amy, in your list of corporate university chairs, you forgot my favorite, the Elmer Anderson Chair in Corporate Responsibility, named for the former Minnesota governor and the CEO of the Fuller Brush Company, which has a habit of exporting toxic glue and other substances of the third world that are banned in the U.S. But I would like to ask Professor Soley, what about those folks who say, look, costs of university education are rising, government support to students, tuition is decreasing, the university has to reach out for new sources of funding?
Well, my response to that is that the reason that tuition rates are going up is because the relationship between corporations and universities. In fact, if you plot the rising costs of tuition and the increased costs of getting an education, you'll see that those escalating costs actually began around the time that the University Small Business Patents Procedure Act was passed. And one of the reasons for that is that universities have discovered that in order to do this type of research, you need state-of-the-art technology. You need state-of-the-art laboratories. And so they have embarked on very ambitious programs to build high-tech laboratories, high-tech research centers. And these have proven very, very costly. And yet when corporations go to the university to get access to these technologies, they pay a relatively limited amount of money. For example, here at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, a paint company, Rust-Oleum, went to the university to try and find out what components in their paint were causing rust. And, of course, Rust-Oleum didn't have a high-tech laboratory. The way that they used to do their research is they used to paint samples out, leave them out in the sun and rain and in salt, and see which corroded. Well, what they did is they went to the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee here, and they asked to use high-tech equipment like electron spectroscopy, electron microscopy, to determine what the components were in their paint that was causing corrosion. And indeed, the university was able to discover that there was indeed a sulfide component in the paint that was causing some of their latex paints to corrode early. That's the type of technology that's necessary to do state-of-the-art research. That's one thing. Another thing is that with the increased emphasis on research at universities, we've seen a decline in the number of courses that professors teach. So today, professors at most universities are now teaching far less than they did in the late 1970s, and they get reduced teaching loads whenever they receive a contract or a grant from a corporation, or whenever they accept an endowed chair, or whenever they're overseeing a research center or a think tank, and that sort of thing. In fact, I'm not the only one that has argued that. There was a study that was published last year in the Chicago Tribune, where they got access to the financial records of the University of Rhode Island and systematically analyzed them and concluded that research actually causes universities to increase their tuition rather than decreasing it. So the story that we've heard about corporate money actually lowering tuition rates is false. It's actually the other way around.
So, but in essence, then what we have is the continuing corruption of university life. Why have the student organizations like the National Student Association or the unions of professors not raised a stronger opposition to this trend?
Well, there are a number of student groups like the Center for Campus Organizing based in Boston that have raised the issue. It's raised rather repeatedly at some campuses where corporate presence is quite visible. And usually it's raised when it becomes visible. For example, at the University of Wisconsin, when the contract was signed with Reebok, there were large-scale protests against that. The problem is that the direction of universities is set at the highest level by the boards of trustees, the boards of regents, and the boards of trustees are dominated by CEOs, so that if you were to look at, let's say, New York University, you'd see on the board individuals like former CBS owner Lawrence Tisch, Hartz Mountain chief Leonard Stern, Solomon Brothers founder William Solomon, and even at smaller universities like the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, you'll find on the board of trustees, individuals from Montgomery Ward and Company, Graco Incorporated, 3M, Waldorf Corporation, and even Honeywell, the corporations based in the Twin Cities. And so students really aren't in a position to affect change, despite the large number of protests at the University of Wisconsin. The Board of Regents approved the contract between Reebok and the university, and this goes on in case after case after case. The reality is that in most instances, the relationships between universities and corporations are not as visible as in that case. For example, the Deng University of San Francisco case that we talked about earlier concerning Boots Pharmaceutical became publicized only because Boots yanked the article away from a major medical journal, which was just on the verge of publishing it. And as a result of that, it got publicity largely as a result of the journal raising the issue, that medical journal raising the issue, rather than being released to the public before then. In fact, most people at the University of San Francisco, or for that matter at the University of Michigan or the City University of New York, aren't aware of the provisions of the contracts that are signed between universities and corporations, because these are proprietary contracts and they're not public.
Professor Lawrence Sully, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, he is the author of Leasing the Ivory Tower, The Corporate Takeover of Academia. It's published by Southend Press. You can ask your bookstore about it. Go to an independent bookstore if you can, or you can call Southend Press in Boston, Massachusetts. He's also author of the piece in the latest edition of Covert Action Quarterly called Phi Beta Capitalism, Universities in Service to Business. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. For 6 years, tens of thousands of Gulf War veterans have been fighting for their lives. Veterans have developed extremely high rates of previously unknown diseases, birth defects and deformities, cancers and leukemias. But the veterans say that official Washington, and particularly the Pentagon and the CIA, have been criminally negligent in dealing with their concerns. Today in Washington, a group of veterans and activists, including former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, will be holding a news conference to demand an independent inquiry into what they believe is a likely cause of Gulf War syndrome, the military's use of depleted uranium weapons. And joining us right now to talk about the news conference as well as a book that's just come out on the subject called The Medal of Dishonor, How the Pentagon Radiates Soldiers and Civilians with Depleted Uranium Weapons, are two people. We're joined by Dr. Michio Kaku. He is a theoretical physicist and professor at the City University of New York. And we're also joined by Dr. Helen Caldicott, an Australian physicist and anti-nuclear activist and founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. She was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. I got a chance to talk to both of them last night, right before Dr. Caldicott headed down to Washington this morning to join Ramsey Clark at that news conference. And I started by asking Helen Caldicott about her entry in the book Medal of Dishonor. I asked her about this new kind of nuclear war.
Yes, well, in the past, nuclear war was when you blew up bombs with fission and you had the most incredibly massive blast effects and radiation effects. Now, this nuclear war is different. The Gulf War was, in truth, a nuclear war. Almost 1 million depleted uranium shells were used. Now, uranium is radioactive. It's a naturally occurring element. And when you remove the fissionable product of uranium, U-235, from the naturally occurring ore, you get a lot of what's called U-238, which is not fissionable, but is very dense. It's about 1.7 or 1.6 times denser than lead. And so it's terrific for shells, because if you use it for shells, it totally penetrates the tanks. But the problem with it is when it hits a tank and there's a tremendous sort of impact, it spontaneously ignites, forming tiny aerosolized particles which can be inhaled into a person's lung. It emits alpha radiation like plutonium. It's not as deadly as plutonium, but it's certainly carcinogenic. It's a heavy metal, therefore it causes renal damage. And I'm quite sure that at least half the Gulf War syndrome impact has been caused by uranium, which was used in the Gulf War area. And there are children now still playing with the shells lying around in the desert, the empty shells.
So, Dr. Helen Caldicott, you and Ramsey Clark today are calling for an independent inquiry into the use of depleted uranium in the Gulf War?
Yes, and it must be piggybacked onto the inquiry about chemical weapons that were apparently blown up by the Americans in the Gulf War. And I would like to see Philip Sheehan and Matthew Wald from the New York Times writing about this. In other words, some good investigative journalism, because as we know, the Pentagon for years covered up the chemical weapon situation, but the really secret one and the scary one for the Pentagon is the nuclear aspect of this war, and you may be sure they've covered that up big time, and maybe they've even shredded some of the documents, but all the evidence is there. It's a very serious issue.
Dr. Michio Kaku, what does the Pentagon understand about depleted uranium, and what are they not telling us about what happened during the Persian Gulf War?
The Pentagon is not telling us the full extent of the contamination and the total tonnage of depleted uranium which was used on the battlefield. We have to, it's almost like pulling out teeth. We have to use freedom of information in order to gain access to files to find the full extent of the problem. Now, you realize that we are crossing a certain firebreak with regards to the use of nuclear waste on the battlefield. Documents released from the government have shown that during the Korean War, General Douglas MacArthur had a plan to use nuclear waste to divide North Korea and South Korea for tens of thousands of years. The plan was to create a radioactive demilitarized zone separating North Korea from South Korea by dumping large quantities of nuclear waste, perhaps radioactive cobalt, between North and South Korea, in order to create a permanent separation of those two countries. If that had been done, of course, perhaps thousands, tens of thousands would have been killed by the radiation, and we'd still be feeling the effects of it. So the whole use of radioactive waste on the battlefield, I think, is a way of in which we're crossing a firebreak, and that is why many people have called for international controls on this before other nations are also tempted to use their excess nuclear waste as a military weapon on the battlefield.
In the new book that's come out, Medal of Dishonor, Depleted Uranium, How the Pentagon Radiates Soldiers and Civilians with DU Weapons, that's depleted uranium weapons, you give a history of the use of depleted uranium, or at least the use of uranium.
That's correct. We have to realize that we've known that uranium is carcinogenic for hundreds of years, going back about 300-400 years when the Bohemian uranium miners came down with what is called mountain disease, which we now know to be lung cancer caused by the emission of radon gas. And then, of course, near the turn of the century, when radium became very popular, radioactive products were dispersed into commercial products as being medicinal. And we now have horrible stories of people that were poisoned by radioactive products near the turn of the century. We now realize that instead of being medicinal, it actually created cancers on a large scale. And then, of course, the use of depleted uranium is one more excuse to get rid of nuclear waste, this time on the battlefield. If you go to the American Southwest, you see hundreds of millions of tons of radioactive tailings, which are also byproducts of the nuclear fuel cycle. And many of these radioactive piles of tailings were used as landfill for housing projects. So the same kind of depleted uranium wound up in people's foundations. And the old Atomic Energy Commission, in a great embarrassment, had to come down to Grand Junction, Colorado, and dig up people's foundations because it was emitting radon gas. And radon gas is highly radioactive, and it goes right through gas masks, by the way. Even activated charcoal in a gas mask will not stop radioactive radon gas. So there's been a long history of this, which many people are not aware of. Many people know of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, but they don't realize that the byproducts of the mining and milling of uranium have also had a long history of creating cancers and causing injuries in the workplace and in the home.
Why is depleted uranium used?
Depleted uranium has a tremendous military advantage in the sense that it goes right through ordinary metals and penetrates tank steel. I was in the United States military for 2 years myself, and I fired anti-tank weapons, and I was very impressed with a handheld device, you can blow up a tank, but it's very difficult to penetrate, 4 or 5 inches of battleship steel. And the way you do that is with a very heavy element called uranium, which is quite heavy. If you put it in your hand, it's unusually heavy. It just drops to the floor, and it's strong enough to penetrate right through tank steel, and that's the reason why we've now coated most of our shells with depleted uranium in order to wipe out heavy armor on the other side.
This is a horrifying question for pacifists to say, well, what could be used instead?
Negotiations, and I think reason, and I think the meeting of minds is the way, rather than the use of uranium in terms of strengthening the battleship steel of our tanks and what have you, because even depleted uranium didn't solve the Middle East crisis. The Middle East is just as much in turmoil today as it was then. Some people think that the U.S. position has in fact eroded since the beginning of the Gulf War. So I think on the negotiating table, that's where we really have to engage in engagement rather than with depleted uranium.
What is the half-life of uranium?
The half-life of uranium, U-238, is the life of the solar system, which is about 4.5 billion years. So we're accustomed to thinking of half-lives in terms of 8 days for radioactive iodine used in hospitals, up to 20,000 years plus for plutonium. But the half-life for natural uranium is the age of the sun, the age of the Earth, and the age of the solar system, about 4.5 billion years.
So what can be done to get rid of it?
It's going to be quite difficult to get rid of it on the battlefield because we now know that there's literally hundreds of pounds, perhaps tons, of the stuff in aerosolized form, micron-sized form that can be inhaled in the lungs. And uranium dioxide is not water-soluble. It'll stay lodged in the lungs and will irradiate tissue for many decades. And it means that we're going to have to decontaminate large portions of the Persian Gulf and the desert because of the widespread use of depleted uranium.
We're talking to Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a theoretical physicist at City University of New York, at City College in New York City. We're also joined by Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is a pediatrician, longtime anti-nuclear activist, founder of two anti-nuclear organizations. Dr. Caldicott, for years in the 1980s, you were in this country, the 1970s and the 1980s, you were in the U.S. really helping to force a paradigm shift in the way people thought about nuclear power. It seems like that same kind of paradigm shift is necessary today. I mean, there are 5 congressional committees looking into what is making Gulf War veterans sick in particular, and yet there's tremendous amount of suspicion that these kind of things couldn't make people sick.
I don't think the committees investigating Gulf War sickness or illness have been investigating the depleted uranium part of the Gulf War. Certainly, from my reading, there's never been any mention of it. In other words, there's a huge cover-up, Amy. And the other thing that worries me is that not only has America made millions of these depleted uranium shells, and also they cover the tanks with an apron of depleted uranium to stop the shells getting into the tanks, but that they are exporting all over the world depleted uranium shells to other countries. So they're exporting nuclear war or potential nuclear war. I mean, it's really, from my perspective as a physician, it's evil.
Helen Caldicott and Michio Kaku. Helen Caldicott, an Australian physicist and anti-nuclear activist, founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Michio Kaku, a theoretical physicist and professor at City College at the City University of New York. Dr. Helen Caldicott joins Ramsey Clark today at a news conference in Washington, D.C., calling for an independent inquiry into Persian Gulf War sickness. When we come back, we'll be joined by a retired Army nurse and veteran of the Gulf War. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're joined now by Carol Piku, a retired Army nurse and veteran of the Persian Gulf War. She served with the 41st Combat Support Hospital during the Gulf War and worked among miles of incinerated Iraqi vehicles on the Highway of Death out of Kuwait City. She co-founded Mission Project afterwards, Mission Project, Military Issues Surfacing in Our Nation. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, ma'am.
Well, you are one of the contributors to this book that is being released today, along with the news conference that's being held in Washington, the National Press Club, that you will be speaking at, Medal of Dishonor, How the Pentagon Radiates Soldiers and Civilians with Depleted Uranium Weapons. What was your exposure to what they call DU?
I was not only a nurse for the intensive care ward going into Iraq, I drove a 5-ton truck tow in the first operating room behind it. And as we came out of the desert, of course, there was a lot of shrapnel and debris in the desert. But once we entered onto the highway heading into Basra, going towards Kuwait, I saw a lot of armored vehicles that the Iraqi army vehicles that were penetrated. And these vehicles were extremely burnt. They were black. The people were so burnt that they were even melted inside to the sides of the vehicles and inside the vehicles. I've never seen anything like that, even when I experienced tank accidents when I was serving in Germany and we received those patients. They weren't like this at all. So I had an alarm go off in my mind saying, you know, guys, something's wrong here. This shouldn't be looking like this. This isn't normal. These vehicles were still burning as we were passing by in the convoys, and then we stopped for 2 hours in that heavy traffic and continued to see all the burning vehicles that were taking place there and being destroyed. And then we moved down the road and only like 1/4 mile off of the highway to set up our hospital, start taking care of casualties.
And what happened subsequently to the other members of your unit as time went on? What happened subsequently to the other members of your unit as time went on? You talk about the illnesses and the problems that they then encountered.
150 people went to the front, and 40 of us became seriously ill. When we returned back, we started reporting our illnesses. And so far, 6 people in our unit have died from homicides, suicides, and natural death.
And what happened to you?
I noticed I started having bowel and bladder incontinence, and I started having memory impairment. I started catheterizing myself in January of 92, and I wear diapers to this day because I have lost a lot of my muscle control. I have no bladder control, no rectal control, no vaginal control. All my muscles have deteriorated, and now I've developed a joint deterioration in my wrists. I have thyroid problems now. I've developed neurological problems, toxicity, chemical toxicity. I have a toxic encephalopathy of the brain and a migraine of other illnesses.
Well, there's been speculation, obviously, over the past few years that there were other causes for the Gulf War syndrome, from the vaccines that were used against anthrax to experimental drugs that were used. Why do you think that it's uranium poisoning from depleted uranium that you're suffering from?
Not only were there's a migraine of exposures. You're right that we did receive the anthrax, the pyridostigmine, all those migrants of vaccines, and of course the environmental exposures. But depleted uranium was the first time it was used on the battlefield, and we were never warned of it. We were never protected of it. We didn't receive what depleted uranium was at all, until long after the war was over, when an atomic veteran called me and felt that my symptoms were very similar to his, and he suffered from uranium poison. So I started questioning our Department of Defense and calling for answers. Why has my health... See, I didn't have the migraine of diseases like most of the soldiers came back, complaining of the headaches, muscle aches and pains, the rashes and the fatigue. I immediately lost control of my bowels, my bladder, and my memory started failing. So I felt that maybe this could be the cause of my illness. So I was asking questions, could this be the cause of my health effects?
Supposedly today, the Senate Intelligence Committee will be asking George Tenet some questions about Persian Gulf War illness, about why the CIA did a poor job of keeping the military informed about the threat of chemical weapons during the Persian Gulf War. What do you understand as the CIA's involvement in suppressing information?
I've been attending hearings, and I was one of the first active duty soldiers to attend the first hearings in June of 1993. I tried bringing the depleted uranium to Capitol Hill of a press release in March of 1993. And we went to different hearings from 93 on, National Institute of Health, the congressional hearings, Senate hearings. And we reported, even in my early testimonies, I had photos of the bunkers being blown around us, these tanks that were destroyed. I took photos of what I saw over there on the front lines and brought it to question. And we were all told that this didn't happen. It didn't happen. No, the animals weren't dead around us. These vehicles, it was no type of contamination was a threat to us. We sat in Iraq for over 15 days unprotected. We weren't even in our mop suits until the last day, when we were ordered by General McCaffrey, who came to give us a debriefing on the war. And we were ordered to be in our chemical suits as we drove out of Iraq. We were not informed of any of the hazards on the front lines at all. They blew up the bunkers around us. We supported those bunkers being blown up, but they never informed us of the health effects. Soldiers were getting sick over there, and we have documentations in our records indicating this, and all those records seem to have disappeared. They have, since 1993, have said that this didn't exist, this just didn't happen. Well, all of a sudden this year and last year, they decide that Camisea did happen and that the soldiers were exposed. So And the soldiers experienced it in 1991.
What about the Iraqis or Kuwaitis that you came in contact with? And what did you sense from what you saw over there has been the effect on their populations?
What was interesting is I was in charge of the intensive care ward, and I can remember one of the soldiers, we had to medevac them out and send them to the hospitals further back. And I can remember one, we tried catheterizing. He had this abdominal distension, and he had a lot of fluid retention. And it took us a long time to get his kidneys functioning to go ahead and catheterize him. And I remember them complaining of muscle aches and pains and the joint pains. And you could see their health effects. And now this one came to mind is because I started losing control of my bowels and my bladder and had excessive, I retain all my urine. So I have no urge to urinate. So I have to catheterize myself to relieve myself. And I think back and see the similarities of their illnesses, the rashes that they had on their bodies when we saw them. My concern is in recent reports we've learned about the children, how they are affected and their birth defects. And in my support organization in San Antonio at the time, our children have the same birth defects as the Iraqi children are now demonstrating. Now, the Iraqi soldiers, I'm not aware of, didn't take the pyridostigmine, the anthrax, the botulinum. However, the frontline soldiers and the people that are getting sick over there were exposed to depleted uranium. How much of their illnesses are related to depleted uranium, I don't know if we'll ever find that out, because the American soldiers can't even find out if our illness is related to depleted uranium, because they're only tested the soldiers that are afflicted with the shrapnel in their bodies, the ones that were hit with friendly fire. So trying to get testing on inhaling it or ingesting these particles, which we did in the area that I was in, has been like an act of Congress, and it literally took my congressman from San Antonio, the late Frank Tejeda, to order testing for depleted uranium for me. And I was tested in February of 1994, and I got my test results back in September of 1994, indicating that I have low levels of radiation, and the doctor said it was just indicative of living in San Antonio. However, I only lived in San Antonio 2 months prior to my deployment to war. I came back from Germany and was ordered to go back to the Persian Gulf immediately.
We're talking to Carol Peake, retired Army nurse and veteran of the Persian Gulf War, as she describes what she was doing there and how sick she and many in her unit got after they worked along the highway of incinerated Iraqi vehicles known as the Highway of Death. I wanted to ask you, Carol Peake, about not only the fatigue of going through what you're going through and dealing with these inquiries, but how you get through after all of these years, how you get through to the truth. I mean, I think the American people are suffering from scandal fatigue in this situation. I mean, you keep getting reports and reports, but more and more of you, tens of thousands of soldiers, are sick. You're holding a news conference this afternoon. What exactly are you demanding?
We're demanding an inquiry into the effects of depleted uranium. We're asking for an international ban on the depleted uranium. And the reason why I feel so strong about this is until the government can prove to us that this is not hazardous to our health, it needs to be banned. I've been following the Native Americans that are affected with this, whether it's been mined from their land, to the miners, to the workers in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and to the testing sites around the communities where these plants actually are, to the Persian Gulf soldiers and to the illnesses in Iraq. And it seems to be a trail of people that are suffering from these cancers, a form of cancer, the bone and joint problems. And it's just a migraine of the same symptoms that I am experiencing. Now, my concern is let's test our soldiers to make sure, let's give them a full body count. Let's take a lung count. Let's test them and see if we inhaled it or ingested it. If this is the cause of our illness, and you know, there, then we have a ground to try and help these soldiers to get well.
You know, as I was saying to Dr. Caldicott and Michio Kaku, it seems that the embargo against Iraq has served two purposes. One is to prevent anything going through to the people of Iraq to help them, but also has also been an information embargo on getting news out of Iraq about what has happened to people there, both civilians and soldiers, that might be helpful in also helping you and your fellow and sister soldiers here.
Yes, ma'am. The embargo is something that I have a hard time dealing with because I see these children and the people suffering over there with their illnesses. And to receive the medical care that they are so greatly denied, it really is a criminal act. I have a great concern for not only our soldiers and American people that are affected with depleted uranium, but also what we left in that desert glow. We use a sophisticated weapon, and we have a sophisticated illness, but yet we don't have any sophisticated answers or treatment protocol for this.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Carol Piku, for joining us. Again, Carol Piku, Army nurse, retired veteran of the Persian Gulf War. And if you want to get listeners information on Carol Piku's experience, as well as the whole issue of depleted uranium, you can call a toll-free number to get a copy of this book, Medal of Dishonor, Depleted Uranium, How the Pentagon Radiates Soldiers and Civilians with DU Weapons. That number is 1-800-247-6553. That's 1-800-247-6553. The book Medal of Dishonor, that's M-E-T-A-L, is published by the International Action Center based in New York City. The news conference today that Carol Piku will be participating in, along with Ramsey Clark and Helen Caldicott and others, will take place at the National Press Club.
For a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear, you might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. To those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember.
That's Richie Havens singing Lives in the Balance, and it also reminds me that this past weekend was the 27th anniversary of the killing of the students at Kent State. And speaking of death, not that I want to end on this note, but there are some very important lives to remember today. The news of Paulo Freire's death has been seeping out all over the world now, educator of the poor in Brazil, as well as around the world with his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Queen Mother Moore, as well as Murray Kempton. Some comments, Juan, on these people.
Yes, well, Paulo Freire, at least in the world scheme, was probably the most well-known of educators, and of he served for many years before the coup in Brazil as the superintendent of the Sao Paulo school system, but before that had really pioneered a method of teaching that basically promoted critical thinking among the poor and was emulated throughout the world. A tremendous loss. And, of course, Queen Mother Moore, who has been a fixture in the African-American liberation movement here since the days of Marcus Garvey. She was 98 when she passed away this past week. And she was a mentor to many African-American leaders in this country, a Pan-Africanist, and one of the major people to espouse the issue that still many feel needs to be addressed, which is reparations to African-Americans for the period of slavery. Hers was a great loss. And, of course, Murray Kempton, who Jimmy Breslin said put more honor in the newspaper business than anyone in our time. The gentlemanly critic with the incredibly baroque language style that baffled and thrilled many who read his writing. Kempton once said of Richard Nixon that Nixon's life story was an inept struggle, quote, against the great discipline of his life, the suppression of resentment. And he once said of Mayor Ed Koch, to walk in his wake has been to stumble through a rubble of vulgarities and meanness of spirit. Murray Kempton was gentle but incisive in his comments.
My picture of him is walking through the various conventions, Democratic and Republican, walking with that ramrod posture, holding his notebook and writing everywhere.
And let's not forget he was arrested at the Democratic National Convention, participating with those who marched to the convention hall.
Well, on that note, we end Democracy Now!, which is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. Kenneth Mason is our engineer in Washington. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
There are shadows on the faces.